You must double check the splices, Sage.
I'm telling you, projectionist, that splice was perfect. The problem must have been with the second projector.
Nonsense, Victor. I watched you service both of them. The fault lies with your splicing talent.
I will be so glad when you can figure out what we need to collect for you to build another portal, so I don't have you in my head anymore. I would kill for a moment's peace and quiet.
Oh, I can assure you, Sage. So would I. But let us not forget that you are in my party, eh?
Whatever. Hey, look, the recording light is on the briefcase. I guess the listeners heard our little spat. Sorry, friends. We had a little issue this evening with the first film we were showing at the Starlight Starbright Family Fun Drive-In. Or as you know it better, the Haunted Drive-In. At least, that's what will become known in our time.
Indeed. Imagine the delight of our patrons up above, sitting comfortably with their family and sweethearts in their automobiles. Just as Lawrence Talbot rushes to the aid of Ginny, the best friend of his object of affection. And then the film breaks.
We're just lucky Big Bill wasn't here tonight. I'm telling you, projectionist, I think he's on to us. He knows that something isn't kosher. At least, we were able to get the film repaired in a hasty manner.
Thank goodness for small favors.
You know, I've been thinking about something since we last recorded a show.
What might that be?
Well, you've said before that the first show you ran at this drive-in was 1932's Freaks.
Yes, that is correct.
Last month, we showed 1960's Village of the Damned. That was the first film we showed as The Projectionist. So, were you just confused, or was that just another lie?
I haven't ever lied to you. Not once. I'm not sure why I have to keep repeating this very fact. As to the first film I showed here, it was 1932's masterpiece, Freaks.
That just doesn't make any sense, projectionist.
Of course it does, Sage. This is not my timeline.
What? What are you talking about?
It's quite simple, Victor. The portal from the Retroist Vault didn't just send us back into the past, but to a different timeline.
That's just ridiculous.
Any more ridiculous than that fancy electronic briefcase being able to record what I say? This is magic we are dealing with, Victor. The rules do not apply.
This just makes my head hurt so much. So, how come we are still getting broadcasts from the Retroist if this is an alternate timeline? Convenient, wouldn't you say, that this timeline's Retroist Vault also fell?
Not so, Sage. Who is to say? Perhaps in this timeline, there isn't even a Retroist. Perhaps it's the Retroactivist, This briefcase is connected to our timeline. Those messages begging off anyone attempting to return to the Retroist Vault are from our own time.
I think I need to lie down. Yep, I need to lie down. So, if you... we can create a portal. Will we even go back to our own timeline? Or will we go into the future of this timeline?
I am relatively certain all will be repaired. This will take a while to accomplish, as I've told you. The necessary supplies are not quite as available in this era. But with the longer preparation time, I am 60% sure I can return us to our own time. Better make that 40%.
Well, I'm never going to see my friends and family again, how am I?
Oh, come on now, Sage. Buck up, little trooper. If you don't remove your hands from your face, the listeners can't hear you. I know what will get your mind off our predicament. Let us tell the dear listeners what classic film double feature we are entertaining the citizens of Haddonfield with this evening.
We are showing both 1941's The Wolfman and 1943's Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman.
Yes. Besides the brief moment where the patrons begin to lay into their automobile horns, it has gone rather swimmingly. You have quite a fondness for this film, eh?
Oh, yeah. It's definitely my favorite of the Universal Monster films. In fact, I was introduced to the Wolfman long before I first saw the film itself, thanks to a poster from a Sugar Crisp cereal box. I've shared this story before on the Retroist site, but I guess it bears repeating since we will be, in fact, discussing the Wolfman for this podcast. In my youth, I was around 3 years old. I happened to pull out of a box of Sugar Crisps a poster featuring a Wolfman. It doesn't actually bear any resemblance to Lon Chaney Jr., but the monster is running towards the viewer with a clawed hand outstretched, while behind him, red-eyed wolves are on the prowl. Honestly, it's kind of a frightening image. For some reason, I was allowed to put this poster on my bedroom door, because even at that age, I was already a fan of monster films. Now, I wasn't aware of it when I hung it on my door, but this poster just so happened to glow in the dark. So, when I woke up in the middle of the night, I turned my head to see this nightmarish image, and I had to yank the covers over my head, refusing to take the chance to peek from underneath them to make sure there truly wasn't a wolfman in my room. In the morning, I kind of told what had occurred, and the poster was sadly removed. I guess it was thrown away. But still, I think it planted in my head the seed of being a huge wolfman fan nonetheless.
Now, when did you first catch this fine film?
I saw it one Saturday night on the Late Late movie. My father and I had just come back from the 62 drive-in, though to be honest, I cannot remember what movies we saw that night. It was probably about midway through the film. My father went straight to bed, and I stayed up because, hey, it was the Wolfman, right? Of course, when it came on VHS, we ended up buying a copy. What about yourself, Projectionist? When did you first see this?
When I had the privilege to show it at the Starlight Star Bright of our timeline, naturally. It did quite well, being held over for nearly 2 months.
I've always felt that the big three, when you were talking about the Universal Monsters, are Dracula, Frankenstein, and then the Wolfman. While I, of course, love almost all of the Universal Monster pantheon, it's easy to see why the Wolfman would prove so popular. The character of Lawrence Talbot is, in my mind, the most sympathetic of the Universal Monsters.
Even more so than the poor Frankenstein's monster.
Well, yeah. Of course, Frankenstein's monster is a simple soul who is sadly misunderstood and only becomes violent when attacked, kind of like a wounded animal might react. But something about the plight of Talbot, more so, how masterfully Lon Chaney Jr. plays the character, all of that sympathy, the great weight of guilt of not being able to control his animal side, it's all up there on the screen, especially the 4 other times he played the part, where he wants nothing more than to find a cure or even just a way to kill himself.
Were you aware that Lon Chaney Jr. was the only actor to portray his Universal Monster role in all films that featured the character? Chaney was quite proud of this fact, dear listeners, even referring to the Wolfman as his baby.
Considering the heritage of the Chaney name, Projectionist, is it any wonder that Lawton Jr. killed it in this role? I mean, when your father is Lon Chaney Sr., the man of a thousand faces, the actor who famously would subject himself to painful makeup applications to bring fans the likes of the Hunchback of Notre Dame and the Phantom of the Opera, to name a few, I think you're going to pick up a few acting tricks, right?
You might think that was the case, but the truth of the matter is that Lon Chaney Sr. didn't want his son to follow in his footsteps. He, in fact, demanded that Junior find a profession elsewhere. In this case, Lon Chaney Jr. became a rather successful plumber.
I wonder why Lon Chaney Sr. didn't want his son to become an actor.
It is assumed that Sr. was worried about the toll Hollywood might have on his son. A toll that resulted in great physical pain to the elder thespian. He wanted his boy to have a skill to fall back on. It wasn't until the passing of Sr. that Lon Chaney Jr. turned from what some would say was a forced profession to the one he truly wanted. His first big break was as Lenny Small in the 1939 film adaptation of John Steinbeck's Of Mice and Men, a role that earned the actor critical acclaim and put him on the fast track to stardom.
Wow, I didn't know that. Well, how about we jump into the synopsis for The Wolfman?
By all means, get on with it.
As the film begins, we see a hand reach for an encyclopedia, giving us a close-up of the heading for lycanthropy, or werewolfism, which is a great way to get the viewers up to speed for what they are about to see in this film. The entry goes on to state that, quote, there is a small village near Talbot Castle, which still claims to have had gruesome experiences with this supernatural creature, end quote.
It also briefly lays the groundwork for the importance of the pentagram to those afflicted by lycanthropy.
When we were first introduced to our main protagonist, Larry Talbot, played by Lon Chaney Jr., he's being driven by a chauffeur to the Talbot Castle. Larry's just returning to what I assume is England from his time in America. The reason being his elder brother has passed away, and now Larry is the recipient of being the next in line to become the lord of the Talbot Estates, when his father, Sir John Talbot, played by the Invisible Man's Claude Rains, passes on.
It is rather obvious, Sage, from the interactions between father and son, that Lawrence Talbot was quite overlooked. All of the glory and praise went to his older brother.
Oh, I agree with that. Which is why Larry left for America, to make his own fortune, and to study abroad. Though, to be fair, Claude Rains' performance shows that Sir John feels bad at how he treated his son in the past, and truly wants to make amends. Wouldn't you agree?
Certainly. They attempt to mend those damaged fences between them, with Lawrence Talbot helping his father repair a large telescope in the castle's observatory.
I think we should add that this film is set in the early 20th century. There are plenty of automobiles, lights, telephones, etc. It's while Larry is testing out that telescope that he looks down upon the little village below Talbot Castle and spies Gwen Conleaf putting on a pair of half-moon earrings in front of her window.
Yes! Our main protagonist appears to have voyeuristic tendencies.
Yeah, sort of. It's by accident, but I think it's fair to say that Larry is smitten by her beauty. Gwen, by the way, is played by Evelyn Ankers. And while they have great chemistry in the film, as well as the films they would peer in together later, they would act together in 8 more movies. It was not a friendly relationship on the set.
Do tell!
Apparently, from the very first day of shooting, Chaney thought the actress had thrown a fit about the size of her dressing room, resulting in her receiving a larger one, with Chaney being given the smaller space. This wasn't the case, of course, but I guess it soured their off-screen relationship from then on out. Enkers was quoted many years later saying, quote, "When he wasn't drinking, he was the sweetest," end quote. Friends, sadly, there are many incidents with Lon Chaney Jr. and alcoholism. One that almost cost him his life when he attempted suicide after filming Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein in 1948. Sorry, went off subject there. Anyway, Larry Talbot flirts with Gwen at her father's antique shop, which, by the way, Gwen totally refuses to give him her name. Larry learns her name a bit later in the film. Talbot also kind of creepily lets on that he knows she owns a pair of half-moon earrings. Those he saw her trying on through the telescope. The young woman naturally is about to call her father in, but Larry's able to set her at ease and ends up buying a rather interesting-looking walking cane.
Indeed. A silver-headed walking stick in the shape of a wolf. It also possesses a pentagram upon the side of it.
Larry actually thinks it's a dog, but Gwen sets him straight about it being a wolf, as well as explaining the pentagram is the sign of the werewolf. The young woman goes further by explaining to Talbot that the Little Red Riding Hood fairy tale was a story of lycanthropy, and recites a, thanks to this film, a very famous poem. Projectionist, would you like the honor?
Of course, Victor. Even a man who is pure in heart and says his prayers by night may become a wolf when the wolfbane blooms and the autumn moon is bright.
Well done, projectionist. That particular poem has become so iconic that fans have just assumed it's real, but it was totally made up by screenwriter Kurt Siermack. That famous silver cane, by the way, is the only surviving prop from this classic movie, and it's in great hands. No, it's not in the retroist's fault. It's housed in the collection of the legendary Bob Burns. Bob was a young boy at the time of the filming and would visit prop maker Ellis Berman, who just had the thing laying around his shop. Eventually seeing how much Bob Burns got a kick out of it, being a fan of the Universal Monsters, of course, Ellis just gave it to him. Let's get back to the synopsis. Gwen makes sure to explain to Larry, and we the viewers, that every werewolf is marked with the pentagram, and will even see the five-sided star in the palm of his next victim.
Their little talk is interrupted by the arrival of a gypsy caravan. One that we are told arrives every autumn. Lawrence Talbot refuses to take no for an answer when he asks Gwen out for a date and informs the young woman he will be by to escort her to the gypsy caravan at 8 p.m. sharp.
The filmmakers do a great job to let we the viewers see that Gwen is in fact interested in Talbot. Otherwise, his behavior could be seen as being a little threatening, other than charming. Larry returns back to Talbot Castle, proudly displaying his new cane, and asks his father about it. Sir John not only confirms what Gwen said, but it appears that his father thinks it's a very good idea that he get out and mingle with those he will one day become lord of.
Yes, that's the sign of the werewolf.
That's just a legend, though, isn't it?
Yes, but like most legends, it must have some basis in fact. It's probably an ancient explanation of the dual personality in each of us. How does it go? Even a man who is pure in heart and says his prayers by night may become a wolf when the wolf bane blooms and the autumn moon is bright.
That's funny. That's the same thing the girl in the antique shop said.
Oh, you met Gwen Cunliffe, have you?
So that's her name. I was just looking the town over.
Oh, naturally. Continue to look it over. I want you to know not only the pretty girls, but the old men and women and the young men. Get to know all about them, Larry. They're nice people. They're your people. After all, you're going to run the estate.
Of course, I want to know all of them.
Seem to have made a pretty good start. Well, now, get on with the good work.
All right, thanks. Good night.
Good night.
Lawrence Talbot arrives to find Gwen waiting for him. Why, she's even wearing those half-moon earrings he's so enamored by.
Exactly. There's a delicious bit of cat and mouse to the relationship in the early sections of the film. Gwen relents her teasing of Larry and reveals that her best friend, Jenny Williams, is going to be accompanying them as they visit the gypsies to have their fortune told. On the long walk in the night, through a mist-covered forest, the trio come upon a growth of wolfsbane, which we viewers can't help but notice is in full bloom. And, just in case we missed it, Jenny recites the poem again. After the young woman collects a handful of wolfsbane, the trio head to where the gypsies have set up camp. There, they are greeted by a man, a fortune teller named Bella.
Who is, dear listeners, played by the legendary Bela Lugosi of Dracula fame?
It's a wonderful, if small, role for Lugosi. Jenny goes in first to have her fortune told, while Gwen and Larry take a walk. It appears that the wolfsbane is upsetting Bella, but not as much as when telling her fortune, he spies, in the palm of her hand, a pentagram. Lugosi really does a great job. We the viewers can't help but feel his pain as, teary-eyed, he begs her to leave the camp, to run away. Of course, we already know that Bella is in fact a werewolf. That point is hammered home, though, when the anguished gypsy passes by a horse in the camp, and it reacts in fear. Seeing all of this take place is an elderly gypsy, a woman we will later learn is named Maleva, played by the iconic Maria Uspenskaya, and she happens to be the fortune teller's mother, and knows all too well his dark affliction. Jenny, obviously frightened by Bela's reactions, runs off into the forest in search of her friends. Mere seconds pass before there is the howl of a wolf nearby.
This occurs just after Gwen Conliff admits to Lawrence Talbot that she is in fact engaged. The two are startled to hear the animal call, but not quite as much as when they hear Jenny scream out in pain and terror.
Larry runs off in the direction of the screams, arriving just in time to see a wolf savaging the corpse of poor Jenny.
Remember, dear listeners, this was filmed in 1941. It's not all that gruesome, nor is the wolf actually a wolf.
That is quite true. The werewolf happens to have been played by a police dog named Moose. Apparently, during the scene where they tussle, Moose bit Chaney's hand and broke his thumb and forefinger. Lon Chaney Jr. was a big man, a rough man, who loved to fight almost as much as he did drinking. He was so impressed by Moose's actions that he bought the dog, and the two could be seen together on countless film sets throughout the rest of his years. Back to the synopsis. Larry is able to overcome the wolf, slaying it by beating it to death with the silver cane. But in the fight, he receives a grievous bite on his chest. With Gwen's aid in the timely arrival of Maleva with her wagon, who is obviously attempting to find her son and possibly his unfortunate victim, they take Larry back to the castle. A bit later, the constable and local villagers discover the remains of Jenny as well as Larry's cane, which he dropped after the attack. They also come upon the body of not a wolf, but the beaten-to-death corpse of Bela the gypsy.
The next morning, Lawrence Talbot wakes to find his father, the village doctor, and a friend to the family, Colonel Paul Mountford, played by Ralph Bellamy, arriving in his bedroom to ask a few questions.
Well, the doctor is there to make sure Larry is okay, which is odd, because that wound he received the previous night has now vanished. Colonel Mumford is more concerned by the fact that Larry's cane was found next to Bela's corpse. The young man is quite adamant, however, in that he was attacked by a wolf the night before, becoming very agitated when Sir John and the others doubt his claims. Larry's father asks him to stay in his bedroom and rest, while he and the others convene downstairs in the study. Mumford is quick to explain he isn't accusing Larry of outright murder, but there is no sign of the wolf, only the deceased Jenny and Bela. It is Sir John who remarks that the matter is quite simple. Bela and Larry must have both heard Jenny's cries for help. In the fog, they chase the animal off, but in the fight, Bela was accidentally slain by Larry. Mumford doesn't exactly buy this, but agrees to let the matter lie until Larry is feeling better.
Later that day, Lawrence Talbot made sure to pay his respects to Bela, who's being held in a crypt until the gypsies pay their respects in their own way. A celebration of his life. One in which all in the village are invited to help celebrate.
While feeling guilty and confused over having a hand in Bela's demise, Larry hears the village priest and Maliva approaching. The clergyman is upset over the celebration to take place that evening, seeing it as something akin to paganism. Talbot hides behind a pillar in the crypt as Maliva looks upon her slain son and then recites a prayer that is almost as famous as the Wolfman poem, a sorrowful promise of a better life for the dead. Later that day, after having a chance to meet Gwen's father and her fiancé, he has a fateful run-in with the old gypsy woman later that evening. Understandably, Maliva doesn't want to join in the festivities, nor does Larry, as he's starting to, well, see things. Maliva orders him into her tent, where she tells the young man what he has already begun to suspect.
You killed the wolf.
Well, there's no crime in that, is there?
The wolf was Bela.
You think I don't know the difference between a wolf and a man?
Bela became a wolf, and you killed him. A werewolf can be killed only with a silver bullet, or a silver knife, or a stick with a silver handle.
You're insane. I tell you, I killed a wolf, a plain, ordinary wolf.
Take this charm, the pentagram, the sign of the wolf. It can break the evil spell.
Evil spell, pentagram, wolfbane. Oh, I'm sick of the whole thing. I'm going to get out of here.
Whoever is bitten by a werewolf and lives becomes a werewolf himself.
And we're going to stop with a synopsis right there, friends.
What?
Yep. This is a classic movie, and I'm not going to ruin it by going any further. Larry, hearing that he has now received the same dark affliction that Bela was stricken with, is a perfect place to stop. Do you have any drive-in ads you wish to share with the listeners before we wrap up the show?
It's not the same dark affliction, Sage. Bela was a werewolf, where Lawrence Talbot is a wolf man. It's never explained why the difference. Perhaps it's because Lawrence Talbot was holding that silver cane when he killed Bela and received the bite, inflicting him with lycanthropy, eh? As to the drive-in ads, yes, I do have some to share. Although we can't use the projectors upstairs for the radio broadcast, dear listeners, Sage and I were able to set up this 8mm projector for our own amusement.
You are invited to an open house where horror will be your host. The Haunted Palace. You, who find a kind of macabre joyousness in the horrifying, will enjoy yourselves as in ecstasy in The Haunted Palace, starring Vincent Price, a being who lived and died and lives again.
I'll not have my fill of revenge until this village is a graveyard.
And intriguing Deborah Paget, whose appealing beauty inflames the blood of the bloodless.
Charles, please.
Well, I've been very busy, but I'm back now.
Charles.
We have the whole night before.
His violent, torturous passions inflict both pain and terror. Lon Chaney, carrying on a family tradition of masterful motion picture horror, while the strange and feared new master of the Haunted Palace reaches for the skeleton of one long dead.
You see? He's taken her mind, her soul,
just like the others.
Really, this is outrageous.
Listen to him.
years, I'm entitled to a few small amusements.
Friends, at the behest of many of you, we are going to curtail the amount of info we share concerning the cast and crew from now on. The Wolfman was directed by George Wagner, who might be best remembered for his long run directing episodes on 77 Sunset Strip. Kurt Siedermacher would not only write the screenplay for 1943's Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman, but also that same year, he would write I Walked with a Zombie, and would provide the story ideas for House of Frankenstein and Son of Dracula. Lon Chaney, quickly dropping the Junior from his name, would have a long career as a character actor, appearing in such films as 1952's High Noon and 1958's The Defiant Ones. Chaney also was the only actor to play all of Universal Pictures' monsters, playing Frankenstein's monster in Ghost of Frankenstein, Garrus in The Mummy's Tomb, and a vampire in Son of Dracula. Claude Rains would go on to appear as the Phantom of the Opera in the 1943 remake of the Lon Chaney Sr. film. He would also appear in 1939's Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, 1942's Casablanca, and 1962's Lawrence of Arabia. Maria Uspenskaya would end up becoming a very famous acting teacher, but also appeared in Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman, as well as 1949's A Kiss in the Dark. Evelyn Ankers would star in 1942's Sherlock Holmes and the Voice of Terror, 1943's Son of Dracula, and 1944's The Pearl of Death, which was also a Sherlock Holmes film. The projectionist mentioned that Ralph Bellamy was in this movie. Listeners, you might know him best for his roles in 1968's Rosemary's Baby, 1983's Trading Places as Randolph Duke, or maybe from 1990's Pretty Woman. And I guess that about wraps up our episode.
Not so, Victor.
No? What do you have to add, projectionist?
Merely the fact you've managed to completely skip discussing the amazing makeup effects of Jack Paris.
Oh. Oh my, you're right. Sorry about that. Go for it.
Jack Paris was responsible for not creating just the Wolfman's look, but for providing the wittest grin for Conrad Veidt's role in 1928's The Man Who Laughs.
That is the film, friends, that DC Comics claims inspired the look of Batman's arch-nemesis, the Joker.
May I continue?
Yeah, sorry.
Jack Paris was responsible for creating the iconic look of Boris Karloff as the Frankenstein monster. And the makeup effects maestro would work with Bela Lugosi in 1932's White Zombie, applying his art to the extras who portrayed the living dead. He would work with a different type of the living dead that same year when he teamed up with Karloff again to design and apply the makeup for Imhotep, the mummy. These makeup effects stand up to scrutiny today, though they were hard on those who had to endure them, such as Lon Chaney Jr. The two men seem to have developed great dislike for each other, but having said that, they always got along for the sake of the film. It was in 1946, after 20 years with Universal Pictures, Jack Paris was sacked. The reason? Many claimed his temper and his resistance to work with the more popular latex makeup effects of the day were what got him the boot. These are not true. Paris was quite skilled with latex. No, it most likely had to do with Max Factor, the cosmetic company, having an in with the heads of the studio. They were able to get Bud Westmore, the youngest sibling of the heads of Max Factor, hired to head the makeup department. Would you believe that Jack Paris doesn't even have a star on Hollywood Boulevard, even after all of the film icons he helped to create?
That's horrible. At the very least, though, projectionist, his legacy lives on, right? I mean, if you ask a young child to draw a picture of Frankenstein's monster, I bet you a box of fresh popcorn that it will look very much like Boris Karloff from 1931's Frankenstein.
Perhaps.
And I think that about wraps up the episode. On behalf of the projectionist and myself, we thank you for listening to the Saturday Frights podcast. The music you hear at the beginning of the show was provided by Peachy. If you'd like to contact him, you may do so at peachy@retrowest.com. Our ending theme is entitled Twisted Toys and was composed by the talented Tony Longworth. You can listen to even more of his music on SoundCloud and on his official site, which you can reach at www.tonylongworth.com. Of course, I have to give thanks to the invaluable feedback to my co-host, the man stuck in my brain, the projectionist. Where can your fans find you if they wish to contact you?
I do not care for the current technological standards, but I am sometimes on the Facebooks. Projectionist Haunted Drive-In.
We do have a Saturday Frights Facebook page as well, and we would greatly appreciate it if you could stop by and give us a like, or even let others know about it. It's another spot where we can share our love of retro horror with you, and not have to wait until Saturday to do so. Our podcast is, of course, available on iTunes and Stitcher, and I can be found nearly every day on The Retroist. If you have any suggestions for future shows or even feedback, you can contact me at VicSage@retroist.com. We owe a great debt of gratitude to The Retroist himself. When you have retro needs, and we all do, just head over to www.retroist.com. Until next time, remember to replace your car speaker on its post before leaving the drive-in, as we play the trailer from the subject of our next show.
First there was Frankenstein, then Dracula, and the creature from the Black Lagoon. Now there's something no one's ever seen before.
What the hell are they?
It's big. It's mean. It's ugly.
Stinks too.
And worst of all,
run!
It's hungry.
Makes my skin crawl.
Kevin Bacon. Tremors, rated PG-13. Special sneak preview tomorrow night in select areas.
This has been a Retro West production. Goodbye.